This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, we share stories that are funny, strange, heartbreaking, and above all, true.
I myself have been married for 56 years. Unfortunately, to four different women.
It turns out the people I was looking for all my life is what you people would call nerds.
Follow and listen to The Moth on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
6:13, what light rain is left should be gone by 8 o'clock or so. And then it's going to be chilly. Highs of 55. It's 55 right now. Temperatures fall throughout the day, and then it turns really windy afternoon. So it's going to be, boy, chilly and 50 and cloudy and windy and all that stuff. Lows tonight, 32 on the north shore, 31 rather on the south shore, and then maybe a little bit harder freeze on the north shore. I'll get it out eventually. And then highs tomorrow of only 46, first big parade weekend, highs of 49, but lows on Friday night in the 40s. That means it's going to be chilly for parade time. Then a 40% chance for showers Saturday with highs of 56. And an 80% chance for showers on Sunday, highs of 53. But then that all depends on the timing of the showers, right? And then dry until Thursday when another chance for showers pops up. But we'll try to check in with a meteorologist and maybe Brooke Laser see what the parade forecast is at some point this morning. Justin Buechler joins us now, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. If you're a Republican or a Democrat, do you want your party to become more conservative, more liberal, more moderate, or stay like it is? There's a new Gallup report out on how Americans answered that question. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You know, I was watching, I remember as a kid reading Sunrise at Campobello, the play about Franklin Roosevelt, and it just so happened that I was recovering from a little minor surgical thing yesterday, and there was a quote in there that he quoted the character of Franklin Roosevelt. I don't know if it's a true quote or not, from Woodrow Wilson. Wilson said that, "I often think of something Woodrow Wilson said to me. It is only once in a generation that people can be lifted above material things. That is why conservative government is in the saddle for two-thirds of the time." Now, I don't know if Woodrow Wilson really said that or not, or if they took some license with the play, but it seemed kind of accurate to me. Thoughts before we get into the subject matter here?
So I don't know the quote, but my reaction to that is actually rather similar to my reaction to a lot of these questions, which is define conservative. Mm-hmm. Because it's not clear what conservative means in that quote. It's not clear what conservative would have meant at that time. The label conservative has changed over time, and it's not really clear what any given survey respondent thinks when prompted with the word conservative, because the word conservative, just like the word liberal, can mean a lot of different things. And what a lot of people have in their heads for these terms, liberal and conservative, is what we can sometimes just call a floating abstraction that's relatively poorly understood. And if we don't define our terms, we prompt survey respondents with these words, and their responses need to be understood in the context of survey respondents' limited understanding of the words.
You know what? You ought to be a political scientist, because that was very well said. When I hear conservative, and at least when I saw this, and I always try to think of, is everything old new again, right? Are we really charting new ground or not? And I always thought of conservative, at least, and maybe it's because of my own viewpoints, as conservative means business first from the top down, government gets out of the way of business, and then the nation of this, the business of this nation, maybe Franklin Roosevelt said this or not, I don't know who said it, but the nation, the business of this nation is business. Then from there, the economy grows, people prosper, etc. But when I hear liberal, I think the other way around, that it's, well, no, the government starts handing out money to help people, and then from there, the economy is stimulated. Now, that might be more of an economic outview than a political outlook on this, but at some point, conservatism to me has morphed into telling people what they can do and can't do socially with their lives. Am I wrong here or not?
Well, to some degree. So, for example, one of the ways that we will sometimes describe the ideological division is we'll talk about social intervention, non-intervention, and economic intervention, non-intervention. So, with respect to social liberalism and social conservatism tends to have more intervention. Social liberalism tends to have more non-intervention, but economic conservatism tends to have more non-intervention. Economic liberalism tends to have more intervention. So what we describe as conservatism more generally is economic non-intervention, social intervention, and liberalism.
Slow down a little bit. What we describe as conservatism, you were saying, is?
Yeah, so conservatism is social intervention, but economic non-intervention. Really? What we describe as liberalism is economic intervention, but social non-intervention. So the ideological division is where you want the government to intervene. To be a liberal is, in the modern world and in the United States, is to want the government to intervene in the economic realm, but not the social realm. To be a conservative in modern America is to want the government to intervene in the social realm, but not the economic realm. And that's kind of the division, or at least this has been, and it's been getting more complicated in the last few years. As the Democratic Party has been changing the last few years, and Republican Party has been changing the last few years. So, for example, you've seen more advocacy for economic intervention under Donald Trump and his preferences. The Democratic Party has been changing a bit, but that's generally been how we describe the ideological division for the last couple of decades.
Let me ask the audience at 504-260-1870. You all describe a conservative for me and describe a liberal, how you view that. I guess I would be more libertarian because I always thought as a conservative, and that's what I thought I was for a while, Justin, that I just wanted the government to get out of the way of business. I wanted the government to fix roads and bridges and collect taxes that they have to, not overtax anybody, spend the money responsibly, but stay the hell out of people's lives. Don't tell me who to marry, what to do, where to go, how to do this or that. Just do what governments do. And then it seems as though, and I don't know if there was a tipping point or not, where it changed to now conservatives want government involved in the social lives of people. And I never did understand how that came to be, but maybe you can explain it to me. And we'll talk about the Gallup poll as well when we come back. Justin Buechler, our guest, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. And I'll also ask you that as well, the audience at 504-260-1870. Do you want the government involved in your personal life? What you can do, what you can't do, et cetera. 620 traffic now, WWL. 625, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to a friend, Justin Buechler, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. New Gallup study out says that Americans, Republicans and Democrats, do they want their party to become more conservative, more liberal, more moderate, or stay like it is? Professor, what did this Gallup survey show?
So it showed a couple of things. There are two distinctions, really. There's a difference between how Democrats and Republicans responded to what kind of change they want in their party, and there's a difference between their responses from 2021 and 2025. So the first big difference is that from 2021 to 2025, Democratic respondents seem to want their party to become much more moderate. The other interesting difference is that Republicans are much more interested in maintaining the level of conservatism within their party. So as we were talking a moment ago, the first basic point to keep in mind is that it's not necessarily clear what any given respondent thinks when prompted with the word liberal or conservative. So when I look at these kinds of surveys, I see the basic obvious point that when you examine the Democratic respondents, in 2021, they just won a presidential election, whereas in 2025, they just lost. But a lot of them really expected to win. They were surprised that they lost. So in 2021, 34% wanted the party to become more moderate. But in 2025, that shot up to 45%. So plurality want their party to become more moderate. So it looks much more like just a response to a surprise loss. Then we look over at the Republicans, and we've gone from 34% in 2021 saying they wanted the party to stay the same, going up to 43%. And what's happened is, well, they just won. So they're pretty satisfied with the party. So I would be nervous reading too much of a policy interpretation into these results, rather than just observing that in 2021, the Democrats had just won a presidential election, and in 2025, the Republicans just won, and you've got survey respondents trying to figure out how to address a presidential election result.
You know, what I'm hearing here as you say that, and back in the day, you know, we used to try to do topics where we'd say, okay, give me your favorite crime movie. And people have a hard time thinking about it. If you give them a choice, it's different if you pick A, B, or C, but just come up with one off the top of their head is hard. And I just wonder how hard it would be for Republicans or Democrats to really quantify what it is that they think is a Republican, is a conservative, or a liberal. You made a good point with that, because maybe it's kind of like, what is it, the Supreme Court's definition of pornography, that they don't can't describe it, but they know it when they see it?
Yeah, if I remember correctly, that was Potter Stewart, but somebody could probably fact check me on that. I may be getting that wrong.
Well, it's not Jeopardy. Yeah. It's not Jeopardy. You know, there's nothing wrong, Professor. You're good. No, but seriously, is that kind of what it is?
I mean, to some degree, but I think it's even more vague than that, because for any given survey respondent, the words liberal, moderate, and conservative have kind of a vague orientation, and to some degree, they're more affective than specific. As I said, I think what's happening is that in 2025, the Democrats just lost an election that they expected to win. So they kind of want some kind of a corrective mechanism. But I don't think any of them can either define it or even really identify it, because in the definition of pornography, there is a claim that you can identify it when you see it. With definitions of ideology, I'm not even sure that people can necessarily identify it when they see it.
And then factor in all of that, ideology be damned, we just want to win and the other guy to lose. Thank you, Professor.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time. Have a good day. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science, Case Western Reserve University. Very interesting conversation. We have another one with Dane Seelin when we come back about Airbnbs in Orleans Parish. Right now, time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7. The rain is supposed to be finished with by 7 o'clock. Their lights have gone off of the Crescent City connection, and I'm having a hard time telling if it's still raining outside or if it's just because the lights are out. Anyway, the rain will be gone soon. Then the temperatures fall throughout the day. Hard freeze across the North Shore Thursday morning, tonight, Thursday morning, tomorrow night, Friday morning. Not so much on the South Shore, but it is going to be cold. Highs today of 58, 46 tomorrow and breezy, so it's going to feel colder than that. 48 on Friday, and then by the time you get to the parades on Friday night, it's really going to be chilly. Saturday, 30% chance for showers, highs of 58. And now they're saying Sunday, a 20% chance for rain. So we'll try to check in with Brooke Laser, get the latest on that. Dane Celino joins us now, professor of law at Loyola, to talk about some Airbnb business. How you doing, Dane?
I'm doing fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm all right. Have you ever seen the movie The Paper Chase?
I have, a long time ago.
It was on Turner Classic Movies the other day, and I watched it, and I just thought of you as John Houseman walking into a classroom with your little seating chart and calling on people to state the facts of the case and then just eviscerating them for getting them wrong. Is that the way?
Exactly.
You
giving them a dime to call their parents and tell them they're not going to be a lawyer.
Wow. Do you do that or not?
I don't know what a dime gets you these days, though, Tommy.
You come in with a skull full of mush, and if you survive, you leave thinking like a lawyer. Let's talk about this Airbnb stuff. I'm trying to understand it, Dane, but I don't know. I really don't. Tell me what's happening.
Yeah, it's a continuing saga between Airbnb and the city. The city wants to regulate Airbnb, and Airbnb wants fewer regulations. You may recall 2 or 3 years ago, Airbnb successfully sued the city because it had imposed regulations on Airbnb operators that essentially discriminated against out-of-state and out-of-city Airbnb operators.
Was that based on a tax exemption or a tax, homestead exemption or not, Dane?
Well, it required that the owners be local. I don't recall whether it was a connection to the homestead exemption or not.
I could be making it up, so don't go by.
Yeah, but it essentially required the owners to be local, and that violated the Commerce Clause of the United States Constitution, and it was struck down. The city went back to the drawing board, and what they came up with was essentially a regulation that requires Airbnb to police the legality of its posters' offerings, to make sure that anybody who is offering a property on Airbnb has a valid license from the city of New Orleans to do so. We all know that there are lots and lots of unlawful Airbnbs across the city. There are people who are posting with fake licenses or expired licenses, and the city is trying to get Airbnb through its regulations to essentially cross-check the operators with the city's list of licensees. And that's what Airbnb doesn't like.
When we say Airbnb, are we using that as a catch-all? Are we using that as kind of like Scott Towel for paper towels? Or is that a specific company? And I'm not trying to sound ignorant on this, but I'm a hotel guy. My kid always books Airbnbs, and I've never been happy, I got to tell you. So
yeah, I guess the proper term is STR for short-term rental, okay. Because there are other VRBO, of course, is the other large operator in that space. But it's the platforms that they're trying to regulate and the operators of the Airbnb properties. And that's who sued, Airbnb as a platform and some operators. This time, they're complaining that they're essentially being forced into enforcing the city's laws when the city should be enforcing its laws. They are also complaining, at least in another lawsuit, about having to the requirement that the operators be on premises. So there's a lot of litigation going on, but I'll tell you, what the city has done most recently by requiring essentially cross-checking posters with licensees is what other cities have done, including New York and San Francisco, and they have done that and have settled some lawsuits and are able to force Airbnb to do that. So I think actually Airbnb and these operators have the weaker argument here. The city does have the ability to regulate these businesses, and I don't think there's anything terribly unusual about requiring the operators to cross-check requiring Airbnb to cross-check the licensees and operators. I mean, it's Uber does it. Uber makes sure that all of its operators have valid driver's licenses and insurance. We require bars to card people when they come in to make sure that they have they're old enough to buy alcohol. This is kind of a variation on that, I would think, and it doesn't seem to be an unreasonable restriction on commerce and something that there is a rational basis for.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. It seems as though, if I'm understanding this right, this is the same thing that New York's doing, that San Francisco's doing, and I don't know where that, in terms of precedent, or if they have different cases, or who adjudicates all of this, we'll find out when we come back. If y'all have any questions about Airbnb or enforcement or whatever we're talking about here, 504-260-1870. Again, I'm a hotel guy, so I have to recuse myself from this. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, 651, 9 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 657 now, 3 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to our good friend Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, about Airbnb bringing another lawsuit against the city over making sure that the people that are on their platform have current licenses. Is that accurate, Dane?
That's exactly right.
All right, so is this any different than other cities are doing? And is this a state law that we're talking about? Because you mentioned Commerce Clause earlier. That's federal. So where? How does all of this play out legally?
Yeah, these are municipal regulations by the city, not state laws. Of course, municipal regulations have to comply with the United States Constitution. And if they don't, under the supremacy rule, then they will be invalidated. That's what happened when the city required the owners and operators to be residents. That violated the Commerce Clause of the federal Constitution because it essentially put up a barrier to out-of-staters coming in to do business. These new regulations, however, are essentially geography neutral. They're essentially just aimed at forcing the platforms, Airbnb, VRBO, to cross-check the operators with the licensees in the city's database, which, given technology today, really shouldn't be a terribly difficult task for these platforms to do. I think you can go online and see a map and a list of operators that have licenses on the city's website. So it seems to me that, you know, the city does have the ability to regulate in this area. The regulations have to be rationally based to some legitimate government concern, and I think these regulations will probably, at the end of the day, pass constitutional muster.
I'm no Dane Cialino, but this would appear to me as though they're just trying to tie the city up in court and play for time. Accurate or not?
Very well could be.
All right. Thank you, Dane. Appreciate it. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. We're going to take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Brooke Laser, meteorologist at Louisiana, WWL, what the hell is it? Channel 4, whatever it is, WWL Louisiana. I think that's what it is this week. We'll talk to her, get the parade forecast, and talk about freezing weather. Then we're going to talk to Tyler Bridges, staff writer for the Times-Picayune. Governor Landry's kind of going about reshaping the Louisiana Supreme Court. We'll talk about the politics behind that. And we're going to talk with Richard Nelson, Louisiana Secretary of Revenue, about Louisianians voting on a proposed tax overhaul next month. Kind of complicated stuff, but we'll get through it. Stay with me. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Brooke Laser, WWL Louisiana, purple, green, and cold. What a forecast for the weekend. That's good, though. The parade should get in. Any rain should be overnight. And our next guest, I am a big fan of this man, Tyler Bridges, staff writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, a skilled journalist, a skilled writer as well. You can go to tylerbridges.com, see the books that he's written, and he can take, it's amazing how he can take something like five laterals and a trombone, Cal, Stanford, and the wildest ending in college football history, and turn it into a full-length book, and it's a very enjoyable read, and you're to be congratulated for that. How you doing, Tyler? Tyler?
Yes, good morning.
Okay, how you doing, all right?
Yeah, life is good, thank you.
Good. Let's talk about what's going on with the Supreme Court, Louisiana Supreme Court, Jeff Landry, and I think first for context, maybe we can talk about differences between a president and the Supreme Court of the United States and a governor of Louisiana and Louisiana Supreme Court.
Yeah. So, Tommy, I think as everybody knows, the United States Supreme Court has 9 members, and they are nominated by the president and then confirmed by the Senate. The Louisiana Supreme Court has 7 members, and they are all elected to 10-year terms. The governor does not appoint the members, but the governor can have a lot of power, and that was the subject of the story I wrote in the Times-Picayune the other day.
When it comes to, and I don't mean to catch you off guard here, but when it comes to re-election, I would think after a 10-year term, chances are you're pretty much a shoo-in to be re-elected?
Very difficult to beat a sitting Louisiana Supreme Court justice
so
when it runs for re-election.
It is a de facto lifetime appointment, would that be accurate?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay. So tell me what Jeff Landry's been up to, the governor, and how he's changed the court, what your story says.
So Jeff Landry, when he took office a year ago, he made a push that surprised some people, which was to redistrict the Louisiana Supreme Court. The 7 justices each represent 1/7 of the state. And every 10 years, of course, Congress goes through redistricting, the state legislature goes through redistricting. But the Louisiana Supreme Court is not mandated to go through redistricting, and it hadn't happened in almost 30 years. And Jeff Landry came in and said, hey, that's not right. And we've got a lawsuit against the boundaries of the existing map. Let's end that lawsuit by redistricting this court and creating a second black district, again, of 7 justices. Only one of them was an African-American, Piper Griffin, here in New Orleans. So Jeff Landry said, hey, let's create another district that will elect a black person to the court. And that really meant it would be electing a Democrat. And that was allowed, that would be possible because a justice up in Shreveport was stepping down. But Jeff Landry is a very crafty guy. He had there was a lot behind the scenes that he wasn't telling everybody. But by getting creating this new second seat, there's a process called packing and redistricting. And so by creating 2 black majority seats on the court, that made the rest of the seats whiter. And by becoming wider, that made them more conservative. Right now, the conservatives don't often have a majority because the Chief Justice, John Wiemer, is a political independent. He's a maverick, as I called him in my story the other day. And if you end up with two black justices and 5 white justices, you're going to end up with a more conservative court, more to the liking of Jeff Landry.
Take me through this again, because does it come down to simple math, 5 against 2? 2 looks good. It's kind of like 49-51. You think you're a half partner, but you're really not, because you're not in charge of anything. Is it almost like that, where on the surfaces it would appear as though we're opening it up, but actually we're not? I guess I'm confused with the size of the district. And if it's, take me through that again, Tyler.
Yeah, sorry. So when you create a second black district, you have to put enough black people into that district, and you take out those black voters from a white district. And so that white district becomes more conservative, more in line, Jeff Landry would argue, with the conservative values in Louisiana. So over time, the white majority districts will elect more conservative justices. And so while people can celebrate the fact that the Louisiana Supreme Court now has a second black justice, the court overall is going to become more conservative.
And there are how many justices on the bench?
There are 7 on the bench.
7, that's what I thought.
On the bench. What the legislature did last year with the backing of the governor was redrew the lines in a way, again, that turned a white majority seat based in Shreveport into a black majority seat in Baton Rouge, but moved all the other lines around that made the other districts, the white majority districts, even more conservative and more likely to elect a more conservative justice.
So on the surface, it would appear as though, okay, we're creating a second district that would lend itself to a black judge. We're expanding the districts that would lend themselves to white conservative judges. And as a result, 5 always beats 2. So we're making the court more conservative for a longer time. Is that accurate?
That's essentially accurate. You know, not everybody's going to vote. You can't predict how everyone will vote on each issue, but that's right. Generally the situation. And Landry also did that by, there was a Supreme Court justice named Jimmy Genovese, who was from Opelousas. Mm. And all of a sudden, one day he gets a call and says, hey, how'd you like to be president of Northwestern State University? in Natchitoches, which is his alma mater. And Genevieve says, well, Scott never even thought about the idea. But Landry maneuvered to get Genevieve to become the next president of Northwestern State, and that opened up a new seat on the Supreme Court. And the new guy who's been elected unopposed is named Cade Cole. He's a solid conservative. He's more conservative than Justice Genevieve was. So by getting Justice Genevieve to go off the court, become the president of Northwestern State, and Landry had the process of selecting Genevieve greased for him, he was able to open up that seat and create a seat for Cade Cole, who's now the latest member of the seven-member court.
I know that because my kid went to Northwestern State and graduated from there with both an undergraduate and master's degree. And I do know that Genevieve had no experience, as I understand it, higher education or running a large institution at all. But Landry said, and I'm looking at your story here, said his people skills and lengthy judicial resume would make him an ideal salesperson to lead a rebound, right?
Yeah. Northwestern State had gone through a difficult time. The student enrollment had dropped. The football team had gone winless the year before. They were clamoring.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
For change, but normally there would be somebody in academia would be the new president, but Jimmy Genevieve is now the president of your son's school.
And there wasn't much of a search there, was there, after Genevieve's name was positioned?
No, Governor Landry paved the way for Genevieve to become the new president. And again, that opened up a seat for another more conservative justice to replace him on the Louisiana Supreme Court.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about the political acumen of Jeff Landry, because he's not, I'm just being honest here, he's not an eloquent speaker, but man, this guy knows his politics. Tyler Bridges, our guest, and Tyler Bridges knows politics as well. Staff writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, author of several books, 723 Traffic Now, WWL. 7:28, couple of minutes left with Tyler Bridges, our friend, staff writer for the Times-Picayune, New Orleans Advocate, author of several books. He got a story out at NOLA.com about Jeff Landry reshaping the Louisiana Supreme Court. Tyler, you know a lot about politics, and you've watched a lot of governors. Jeff Landry, and I don't mean this in a negative way at all, he's not particularly glib, and he's not particularly well-spoken, but when it comes to politics, this man knows what he's doing as it relates to Louisiana, does he not?
Yeah, I think he's beginning to remind some people of the perhaps the best-known Cajun governor of Louisiana, Edwin Edwards, mm-hmm. who served four terms and it was very, very crafty. And Jeff Landry is showing he's very crafty, too. I wrote a story, Tommy, to mark the 1 year of Jeff Landry in office about a month ago. And I reported that he's definitely MAGA on various issues, sounding out on against certain things that Donald Trump would like, you know, in line with what Trump did. But Landry is also very pragmatic. If he wants to get something done, he doesn't care who he needs to negotiate with. And the latest example is the Super Bowl. He forged a very good working relationship with Latoya Cantrell, and they helped deliver what I think most people agree was a super Bowl.
I think the difference between he and Donald Trump, and you can tell me what you think, is Jeff Landry wants you to underestimate him.
Yeah, you know, he's from St. Martinville Parish. He grew up next to a sugarcane field, very different than Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think people do tend to underestimate him, but he's very, very clever at working behind the scenes, kind of moving the pieces on the chessboard, the political chessboard, to get what he wants.
I think from what I know of him, he wants you to think that he's just some, and I mean this just not talking, calling the governor this, but yeah, you go ahead and think of me, underestimate me, think of me as just some dumb Cajun hick. Go ahead, please, keep doing that. And meanwhile, he's pulling the strings behind the scenes. Accurate?
Yeah, for example, I think a lot of people thought he was going to make war against New Orleans as governor. He had run against New Orleans during the gubernatorial campaign of 2023. And yet, I think most people are pretty happy that Troop NOLA is in New Orleans and gets some credit for the reduction in crime. He's trying to help clean up the sewage and water board. Look at the better streets that we've gotten in New Orleans, thanks to the work with Michael Hecht and others before the Super Bowl. So I bet a lot of people in New Orleans are pleasantly surprised with what they're seeing with Jeff Landry as governor than what they expected.
Thank you. Appreciate your time, Tyler, and insight as always. We'll talk to Richard Nelson, Louisiana Secretary of Revenue. We come back 7:31. Time for WWL First News. 7:46, 14 till 8. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Chilly Wednesday morning. It's going to get even colder as the day progresses, even colder tomorrow. But enjoy it, because come June or July, you could be longing for a day like this. Richard Nelson joins us now, Louisiana Secretary of Revenue. Talk about an amendment that's on the ballot on March 29th. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
I went to the Ballotpedia and saw Louisiana Amendment 2 and then went to the print-friendly version of it, and it said print 92 pages. And I said, you know what? Maybe not. Maybe let's just talk to Richard Nelson and see if he can give us an easier explanation of this. It can be complicated, can it not, Richard?
It's absolutely complicated, and that's one of the things we're trying to fix. Is Louisiana has one of the longest constitutions in the country. Mm-hmm. This amendment actually rewrites Article 7 of the Constitution, which is the revenue and taxation article, which is the longest article in our Constitution. And so the idea was to simplify it, I think, you know, leave the things that really need to be in there, you know, pull out anything that doesn't need to be in there, and really just, I'd say, modernize Louisiana's constitution going forward.
So what does it put in? What does it take out?
Sure. So, I'd say the few major things that I think everybody cares about or will get impacted by. One is that it reduces the maximum rate of income tax that can be charged in the state. It sets it at 3.75, which is actually higher than our current rate. So it doesn't impact what your rate is. It just means the legislature can't go back in the future and raise rates above 3.75. It also doubles the standard deduction for seniors. So if you're over 65, you will basically get $25,000 tax-free every year if the amendment passes. It creates a kind of a barrier for special interests to get their own tax breaks. I mean, one of the problems in Louisiana is we're kind of addicted to handing out, credits and exemptions and incentives. And so we tried to get away from that and make it so that it takes a 2/3 vote of the legislature to put these new kind of credits incentives. We really wanted to focus going forward on just lowering the rates for everybody. And that was the thought behind that. It also makes some changes to some of the constitutional funds. So we have about $2 billion in these educational funds in the Constitution. And they get about 3% interest. And so we said, well, if we pay off some of this teacher retirement debt, it helps the retired teachers, it helps the current teachers, it helps the education system, and it saves a lot of money because that money gets a lot better interest and a lot better return if you pay off that retirement debt. And so we make that $2 billion payment and then use that saving, it saves about $300 million a year, to give the teachers a permanent pay raise. And so that part is in the Constitution as well. So there's a lot of things in there. We changed a lot of the, kind of the little mechanisms and tweaks that have kind of been built up over time because amendment or Article 7 has been amended. I think about 80% of the amendments we vote on are to Article 7. And so we tried to slim it down a little bit so we don't have to amend it all the time. And then also kind of build us a foundation going forward that'll make the state better.
Let me take a break. We come back and let's talk about unintended consequences, if there could be any, and what is it that the opposition, what kind of opposition are you facing and what are they saying? And I'll give you a chance to counter that. Richard Nelson, our guest, Louisiana Secretary of Revenue. This is a complicated amendment. This, to me, is the ultimate test of, do you trust the leaders in the state to do what is good for the state? Because I don't know that any of us has time to go through this or the knowledge, unless you put a board together to have everybody break it down into study groups and say, well, this could cause that, that could cause this, could this could lead to that. This, to me, is the ultimate assignation of trust. We'll pick it up. We come back, 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Richard Nelson about the amendment that's coming up on March 29th. So a suit has been filed, right, about the ballot language, saying that the state law requires the ballot language to be simple, unbiased, concise, and easily understood. But some people are saying it's misleading. Talk about that, if you would, please, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the issue with the amendment is that it's obviously pretty, it's not just one thing that you're changing, you're really rewriting the whole Article 7. And so, you know, we picked the language to say, or the legislature wrote the language to say, you know, these are the, you know, these are the things that are most important to people and kind of give them notice of what it is. Of course, you can go online and you can read the whole amendment if you want to. Mm-hmm. As you said, it's almost 100 pages, so it's pretty substantial. So, I disagree that it's misleading. I think it says exactly what the, you know, it says the amendment does.
Let me get to some of the things in the suit. It says that HB 7 is retaining the exemption for religious organizations, but it is not. It is drastically narrowing the religious exemption.
So currently, there's a kind of a catch-all exemption in the property tax section of the Constitution, mm-hmm. and all of that actually remains law. It just comes out of the Constitution. Well, we created a new religious exemption to go along with the homestead exemption. So the homestead exemption stays in the Constitution 100%. And then we created a new religious exemption in the Constitution to cover, you know, churches and it's like churches and religious schools and, you know, parsonages and kind of just basically all the religious facilities that you can think of. So that is an additional exemption that we created inside of the Constitution, and then we took most of the other exemptions besides the homestead exemption and took those out and left them in statute. So the idea was that, you know, these are things that get amended all the time, and we didn't want to leave it all in the Constitution to have to constantly get amended. And so we created a new religious exemption, that's true, but at the end of the day, even the old religious exemption is still in statute, and now it's going to require a two-thirds vote to change. So it really doesn't. It doesn't impact the law at all. It just creates an additional constitutional protection for a religious organization.
Is it based on beliefs of certain religions or not? I'm a little bit confused.
No, it's broad. It just says a religious. I think it's just a religious, place of worship or something like that.
Another thing the suit says that it's going to modify operation of certain constitutional funds, but it's not modifying, says his suit. It's not modifying those funds. It's deleting them entirely.
Well, I mean, we do delete some of the funds entirely because some of them haven't got a deposit since like the 1970s or something like that, right? So we had like 25 constitutional funds. Some of them don't do anything. So we got rid of some of them. Some of them we moved to statute. Some we did just modify. So, I mean, it just changes the functions of a lot of those different funds. Like I was talking about those educational trust funds. We got rid of those educational trust funds, but what we did is make a $2 billion payment to the retirement debt for the teacher system.
Let me get this real quick because we only have a minute left. They talk about permanent teacher salary increase, no salary increase, only the extension of an existing stipend. No teacher will be paid any more than they currently are, and some teachers may be paid less. Thoughts?
They just don't understand how it works, I guess, is the best thing. It's like, so the legislature's been giving a temporary stipend, so they don't have that money, and we're giving them a permanent raise in the Constitution. And so there is a difference between, you know, you here's a check and you get it one time versus every year you're going to get a permanent pay raise. So that's the difference, and the Constitution provides for that.
Thank you, Richard. I hope we have you on again between now and March 29th, because it is a complicated amendment. We'll talk more as the time progresses. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Ronald Surpass, as we do every Wednesday morning, about crime, specifically about Mardi Gras coming up and how difficult is it going to be to manage Mardi Gras as a SEER 1 event. 8:14, chilly Wednesday morning, and it's going to get even colder today. Temperature is going to fall. Rain's pretty much, for the most part, done And then the temperature is going to fall throughout the day, and the winds are going to pick up, and it's going to feel even colder than it does now. Eventually, lows tonight, 32 on the south shore, hard freeze on the north shore. Same for tomorrow night. Friday morning, highs tomorrow only of 46, 48 Friday, 56 Saturday, 54 Sunday. But Brooke Laser tells us from WWL Louisiana that the parade should get in. No rain, just bundle up, as she says, purple, green, and cold. Ronald Serpas joins us now, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, former NOPD superintendent, head of the Nashville City Police, Washington State Police, and more. How you doing, sir?
Tommy, I am great. How are you? You ready for Mardi Gras?
I am all set up. I got my costume ready, and I got my ladders chained already on St. Charles Avenue, and I got the crew going out there today to build the big podium, the reviewing stand. My property extends from, I don't know if I told you that story or not, but I went out there back in the day when I didn't have to work on Mardi Gras, and with the family to set up, and somebody was already there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and they were telling their friend, my property extends from that telephone pole over there to the mailbox. And I thought that interesting. That's a true story. Honestly is. Our property, that's what it was. Our property extends from the mailbox over to the telephone pole. Let's talk about...
Well, I wanted you to know I've been preparing too. I've been working on my shoulders so that I can carry you. You'll be comfortable.
It's not the shoulders as much as the legs, the quads. You got to get ready for those squats. Let's talk about, because Chief Serpas is like 6'8", and I'm 5'0", and he holds me on his shoulders for the parades, which is nice of him, and it looks kind of stupid for a couple of guys our age, but what the heck, we get a lot of beads, and that's what counts. Let's talk about a Sierra One event and Mardi Gras, because they would seem to me at opposite ends of the continuum.
Well, I'm anxious to see, as well as I'm sure most people, you know, what are going to be some of the solution offer, and that's fine. You know, we always want things to get better. But I'm reminded, I saw something in the news last week, and maybe you saw it, where there was going to be some extra authority granted to the police department to clear the neutral ground of people's property and those kinds of things before the parades. Tommy, I don't want to sound like an old guy, but, you know, we have been doing that since 1980, my very first Mardi Gras parade. The culture of New Orleans is that people are going to put their living room furniture, their kitchen furniture, their dining room furniture on the neutral ground. Do we want it? No. Have we been working with the culture of the community for 45 years to stop it? Yes. Have we been successful in stopping it? No. I mean, these are the kind of things that are important, because a Sierra One event tends to look like something that's far easier to control. The Superdome. There's only so many ways in and out. Mm-hmm. NASCAR, if they did it, this year one at NASCAR, they had, 300,000 people. There's ways to do in and out. But the Mardi Gras experience is so intertwined into the streets and cultures and neighborhoods and families of Mardi Gras. I'm anxious to see if there's some other ideas, and I'm sure if they're safe and good, I know people would want to take them. But you can't look at that unless you have some recognition of the 100-year history of the intertwine of just that family, friends, blocks, neighborhoods, and how they experienced this wonderful, uniquely New Orleans event.
And with that being said, you know, I was talking to J.P. Morrell, and he said at the city council, he told NOPD, giving him discretion, maybe that's what you're talking about. It's like, well, you know, you got all the stuff on your minds besides the new, and you got the manpower issues as you've always had, or woman power, however you want to say
God.
It. But you've got, well, anyway, but you've got that, you can get to that in a second, but to enforce the new rules that we put in. Tell me about all of that and your reaction just now.
I haven't had a chance to see the new rules. I thought that it was mostly you have more power and discretion to control neutral ground. And I may totally be missing that, but that's what I thought I read. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, whatever new power the council is going to give, it's going to be interesting, because if it was that important, why hadn't it been asked for before? Has it already been asked for or done? You know, one of the things about history is it does repeat itself. Many years ago when I was chief, I begged the city council to allow us to put, you know, on Canal Street, you have those metal barriers, the metal wires that create a barrier. So people, my administration as deputy chief and my administration as superintendent, we begged the city, why don't we stretch these things along St. Charles Avenue, have easy breaks at the neutral ground, so we can at least keep people in between the intersections from getting into the street, which is dangerous. And we do have the horrible events where people get run over by floats because they got into the middle of the street.
You're talking about the interlocking barricades that the recruits go and put out on a truck, those things?
No, no. Think about on Canal Street, you have the cables.
Oh,
and the
okay.
cables run
yeah.
across the neutral ground. Mm-hmm. I should have said cables, I'm sorry. So when Richard was here as chief, I was the chief operations, we begged the city to cable the parade route. No, we're not going to do it. When I was superintendent, I came back, I said, we really ought to, especially now since we have one route, we really ought to cable this route, because then the police ability to keep people out of the middle of the block going in front of the floats is such a public safety question. And then on the intersections, you can still get people through at the end. But there was no will to do that then, probably because some of the cultural expectations of the experience. So if those come up as ideas, some of the ideas that come up may be things that have been tried and discarded, or things that have been asked for that were never given. And if SEER can help with that, maybe that's a good thing.
I don't know how. I guess the question is, and we can talk about this when we come back. I understand, you know, SEER one event, SEER one event, SEER one event. And that sounds great, but I don't know how that can even apply to Mardi Gras, because it would seem as though everything in the Mardi Gras is what SEER one against would want to prohibit. So you can talk more when we come back, and we'll also talk about the new rules. What the council said was that we have these new rules in place, tents, tarps, enclosures, sofas, scaffolding, all that stuff, but we're going to, this year, because of the Bourbon Street attack and the SEER one event, give you discretion in enforcing all of that, although it seems as though we're back to the same old thing that you're talking about with either you're going to enforce it or you're not, and you can't tell somebody don't put a tarp down or confiscate their tarp, and then 20 minutes later somebody comes down and puts a tarp, and then they're right where the other person was, and we're back to where we started. 821 traffic now, WWL. 827, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Ronald Surpass, professor of practice, Department of Criminal Justice at Loyola, on the job and NOPD for a long time, started pounding the beat, and then he rode a horse, rode a motorcycle, done it all, rising to the superintendent. Let me ask you this, Chief, when it comes to SEER 1 event, we heard so much about it, but it just seems like, okay, we made the announcement, but really, what does it mean? Because when you look at what's involved with a SEER 1 event, that kind of is contrary to what Mardi Gras is, right?
I think there's a very important point you made there, Tom. And I would say this. I did 25 Mardi Gras, like you said, walked the beat on Bourbon Street, rode a horse, did the motorcycles, moving the floats, as did hundreds of other police officers. Mm-hmm. We don't think we know everything, but we have 25 years of doing this. So there's going to be a combination of, I've been there, done that, it might not work, folks. Or this is an interesting piece of surveillance technology that you have that we never knew about in the 1990s, the 2000s, the 2020s. So there could be things, there really could. But I think if, you know, sometimes the process is our local people must not know what they're doing. Let's bring in somebody else. Mm-hmm. And that's fair, except that you can't forget that the local people have done these Mardi Gras parades for hundreds of years. Again, me, 25 years from walking a beat on Bourbon Street to being the chief of police. There are things that we know that are inherent in the relationship of the community and the event, not the techniques of security only, but the culture. What is it to be a New Orleanian? What is it to be a second line? What is it to be a Mardi Gras crew, Mardi Gras Indian crew? These are the kind of things that we have decades of experience that have to be melded with what might be new technologies and techniques from a nationwide perspective, and hopefully the two can come together. My point is, nobody can come to New Orleans or nobody can go to another person's city and say, we really don't know what you've been doing, but this is what we think you ought to do, without listening to what this is what we've been doing.
Let me get
a better picture.
Yeah, let me say it this way. I guess this is what I'm thinking. Mardi Gras is no more susceptible to a terrorist attack than it was 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, last year. The only thing that's changed is a guy committed an act of terror on Bourbon Street on New Year's Day, right? So
I think there's a lot to that, yes.
So I think I don't know how do you let this one guy and his terrible act change everything that everybody else does, because, again, I don't think anybody that would be looking to commit an act of terror would not have already identified the weaknesses that Mardi Gras present. Would that be accurate, Chief, or not?
Well, I think it's very accurate. I think you have to marry what people in this city know is the experience with people who might have greater expertise. on issues that we don't. But you have to recognize that this is a cultural event in a community. If you go back to COVID, we were resisting that police officers were being made to enforce laws that COVID was demanding that the citizens refused to recognize as legitimate. Mm-hmm. So you might run into the same problem here where people with good intentions, like we did, don't put stuff on the neutral ground on Park Avenue. They didn't listen. Were we going to go arrest all those people? Would that have been the answer? I don't think so.
I guess I just got to thinking about it. It's like, well, what's changed really since last Mardi Gras? And the only thing that's changed is this evil guy decided to drive his truck down Bourbon Street on New Year's Day. Thank you, Chief. Appreciate your time.
The other thing, thing that's changed is the city's continuing inability to hire officers back up to 1,200 or 1,600. Just thought I'd throw that out there.
No, and you're right. That's exactly right. Thank you, sir. Ronald Surpass. We'll take a break, come back, talk about child care and couples and so forth. Right now, time for WWL First News. 8:45, quarter till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. If you've listened for these decades, you know that I am very concerned about education because that is the key, I think, to fixing a lot of the problems that we have in society. And that starts at a very early age, and as a result of that, that has also ramifications for the economy in general as it relates to parents. And I'm going to invite Madeline Karst-Batson to join us now, Research and Policy Director for the Louisiana Policy Institute of Children, to join us because she can explain it a lot better than I just tried to. How are you doing, Madeline?
Hi, good morning. I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I got to tell you, and I hope this is not inappropriate, but I've never seen that name before, and I think it's a beautiful name, Madeline.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Named after my dad named Matt. So,
well, there you go. That's awesome. I think that's great. Did you know any other kids named Madeline?
Not spelled for sure. Not spelled the way I spelled it, but
that's great. And a great way to honor your dad as well. Let's talk about dads and moms and cost and availability of child care in Louisiana about this new survey. What does it say, Madeline?
Yeah, well, thank you for having us to share. We are really pleased to be able to release our report once again. You know, we started surveying parents across Louisiana starting in 2020 to really kind of understand what the impacts of COVID were. And then we realized that childcare is an issue for families inside or outside of COVID. So we have continued to try to capture, you know, what parents are trying to navigate as they consider having kids, trying to be in the workforce, and what are the decisions they're making and where are the pressure points for them. And so what we found this year, and really what we found every year, is that the majority of parents who have children under 5 in Louisiana are working or attending school full time and
say that
outside
again?
Of their home.
I don't want to lose that. Madeline, that number again, say it again.
Sure. Most of them, 80% actually of our respondents who are parents with children under 5, say that they are working full time or in school for full time outside of their homes. And so what that means is that, you know, if most of our parents are working full time outside of the home, that means their kids who are under 5, understanding they can't watch themselves, mm-hmm. are going somewhere. And so what we found is that while majority of the parents have their children under 5 in child care centers or center-based learning environments, they still are really struggling with being able to afford that child care while trying to work and provide for their families. And so that's really why we titled the report the way we did. It's called Caught in the Middle. It's because what we really found in our research is that that's how parents are feeling. We've even heard from parents saying in the report that, or in the survey, they share with us that, you know, they quit their jobs to have their child and to care for them when they were infants. They had always planned to go back to work, but that was a year ago that they had their kid and they realized, oh, I can't afford child care, so I can't go back to work, even though that might be something that's important for them and their families. So that's really the gist of what we found. There's a lot underneath, but wanted to give you a chance to respond to that so far.
Well, I'll tell you this, just being honest, as I try to always be, having been blessed, my kid's 28 now, but having been blessed to have a family member that was loved and trusted to watch over the kid was a blessing. And I think a lot of people that have that don't quite understand the challenges that parents that don't have that are facing. Agree?
Correct, yes. And we did find that, I mean, we polled any parent in the state with kids under five, even parents who themselves stay at home to watch their kids. But we did find that the majority of people who responded, which we had over 3,400 respondents across the state, and so we really do feel like we got a snapshot, at least, of what's going on. And the top options for care were a child care center, their child, you know, is eligible for a pre-K seat in a elementary setting, so like in a K-12 setting, but like in a pre-K-4 program. Or they're in a family child care provider space where, you know, maybe that's a neighbor who has a small child care business out of their home. But the majority of people are not relying on their family, friends, and neighbors to have care, which tells us that that option isn't available for them. And, you know, what's interesting, too, is that when we looked at, okay, so you're having a hard time affording child care, over half of our respondents said that. When we look at our highest income brackets, which is up to $150,000 for the family income, we are still seeing that there's difficulty with affording care.
Give me that number again, please, Madeline.
Sure. Parents making up to $150,000 indicated that they struggled to afford child care. But at the same time, over half of our respondents said they have to have child care in order to go to work.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up there when we come back, because if you're making up to $150,000 and you're struggling to afford it, you can only imagine what parents that are making $60,000 are going through, or $30,000 or what have you. So there's also, when we come back, we'll talk about it. One thing is paying for child care and being affordable. The other is it being available, because, again, I was blessed. We were blessed to have a family member that you trusted, but how many of these places, how are they regulated? How many are available? Is it daycare? Is it babysitting? Is there any early education going on? It's a very complicated problem, I think, a very serious problem with some long-term effects, because this to me is like planting a seed, and you can either plant a, I'm not trying to get wax philosophic here, Madeline, but you can either plant a weed or you can plant a flower, right? And one of the two is going to come up. We'll pick it up there when we come back. Our guest is Madeline Karst-Batson, Research and Policy Director for Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, talking about the affordability and availability of child care. Tell me on the Okunard Jeweler Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870, if you would, please. If you have a young child in your family, or under five, or maybe parent or grandparent or friend's neighbor, how do they take care of the child? I'd like to know. 852 traffic now, WWL. 858 now, just a couple of minutes left with Madeline Karst-Batson, Research Policy Institute for the Louisiana Policy Institute of Children. I think maybe, Madeline, you're going to have to come back, because we don't have really enough time to cover this, because I think it's a very important thing. Somebody texted in, me and my wife have a 2-year-old, soon to be 3-year-old, lucky enough to have my father works from home, able to watch him every day. Now they're soon to be 3, trying to enroll in a private school, could take every dollar that we have. Talk about, if you will, in the time that we have left, Madeline, how do you fix this? Is it about affordability, availability, both?
It is a little bit of both. We do know that our quality rating system for our child care centers is top 20 actually in the nation for its validity. And so we know that when child care centers are ranked as high quality, that they actually are, which means that, you know, centers are wanting to care for more kids, but with the high expense that it is, a lot of families just can't afford it unless they have access to some sort of subsidy. And that really means what it boils down to is that we really need state, federal, and local governments to find ways to invest in child care so that we can have the Child Care Assistance Program, which is one of our subsidy programs, able to take more parents so that they can, you know, not have to wonder if they have to go to work or send their child to child care or if they're going to put food on their table even. Some of our respondents talked about that. They're worried about being able to afford other basic expenses because child care costs so much. And so we know that the centers are out there. They served a lot of kids during COVID. And so we know that the capacity is there. We just really need more families to get access to assistance in order to be able to really fuel our workforce, fuel our economy, and then put their kids in a high-quality center where they are learning.
Yeah, I would like you to
prepared for kindergarten.
Come back and spend an hour, because this leads to that, leads to that, leads to that, leads to that. Thank you, Madeline Karst-Batson, Research Policy Director, Louisiana Policy Institute of Children. We'll come back, talk about name, image, and likeness, and where all that mess stands. Tommy Tucker, WWL. All right, 9:09 now on this Wednesday morning. Temperatures continue to drop throughout the day, and we're going to talk this hour about this whole name, image, and likeness mess and paying college athletes. And there are so many questions that I would like y'all to text in with that I know you have at 504-260-1870. It's a morass is what it is, and Matt Brown's here to help sort it out, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. How you doing, Matt?
I am doing wonderful. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Good to talk to you again. Tell me about the Extra Points newsletter, please.
Sure. Extra Points is a newsletter that covers business, policy, and off-the-field stories that shape the college athletics industry. Whether you're a major school like LSU or an FCS institution or Division III, through original reporting and analysis and commentary, Extra Points digs into everything except the games themselves. That shapes how this industry works.
I don't even know where to start. If you want to start with context, Matt, and give us a background, or if you want to start with what 2025 could mean with a new administration and the House negotiations, you are best equipped to tell this story, so please go ahead.
Yeah, I think maybe talking about what's going to happen in the near future might be helpful. And many of your listeners who are college sports fans may have heard of a court case, the House v. NCAA, where there is a proposed settlement to this huge antitrust case that would allow schools to directly pay some money to their athletes. It's a cap of a little over $20 million. And the way that it's set up, if this is all passed and approved, a school like LSU could say, listen, we have this left tackle, and we're going to pay that left tackle $300,000, and we're going to say that he's not an employee. I'm just paying him for his promotional rights so he can appear in LSU football commercials and on billboards and that sort of thing. But then rather than having to have the collective or some boosters or some third party do it, we'll just cut the check ourselves. And we can do the same thing for any of our sports, whether that's baseball or women's basketball or anything else. We will know if that settlement is approved by the federal judge in early April. And everyone right now is just trying to figure out, okay, how am I going to split up this money? How much of this money are we going to spend? Are we going to opt into this settlement? Can we afford to? Difficult questions for everybody from big schools to small schools to figure out over the next few months.
So that, you said $20 million salary cap, right? Is that what you said?
Essentially. So it's like 20.4. We can, you know, colloquially speaking, we could say it's $20 million.
Well, pretty soon you'll be accounting for every dollar. That's an old joke. So when it comes to that salary cap, to whom would that apply?
Great question. So schools, with the guidance that they have right now from the federal government, can essentially decide how they want to split that money up amongst their athletes. They want.
This is $20 million per school?
This is up to $20 million per school, yes.
Okay.
And that's important because there's no obligation to do the whole $20 million, right? LSU and everybody in the SEC almost assuredly will. But if you're Nichols Grambling or any of the other FCS institutions in the state, you might say, I'm going to opt in, but I don't have $20 million. I don't make $20 million. Maybe we'll do $1 million. Maybe we'll just split any merchandising revenue with the athletes directly. Or you can go all the way up. Then the schools have to decide, do I want to give all of this to my football team and then risk everyone leaving my basketball program? How much should I give to women's basketball or to baseball to be competitive? The math is going to look different everywhere across the country.
So if I am a laissez-faire economist and I'm saying, you know what, screw the salary cap, let the market rule. Whoever can pay whatever, let them pay them. Who would be against that? Go ahead.
Yeah, that is a great question. And one, that's against the terms of the settlement. That's something right now that schools really don't want and negotiated with the plaintiff's attorneys to have some sort of cap so we wouldn't have that system, and then or you might have then some schools dropping $60 million and everybody freaking out about parity and fairness of play. But there are ways around this cap, right? The cap just says LSU can only pay $20.3 or $20.4 million a year. It doesn't say anything about raising Canes. It doesn't say anything about any particular collective. What the rules of the settlement say is that any commercial deal that is done outside the scope of the school has to be paid fair market value. So what the settlement is saying here is, like, you can't have Raising Cane's pay some left tackle with 20 Instagram followers $5 million because that's clearly just a way to evade the salary cap. It has to be, you know, in around the same ballpark as what a similarly famous person might necessarily do. But if you're the economist, you might say, well, fair market value is what just what somebody would pay. How can you try to figure this out here on a spreadsheet with Deloitte? And the answer to that, my friend, is probably going to mean lawsuits, because and that, I imagine, will be litigated in the future.
So name, image, and likeness and the collectives would still exist with this settlement?
You know, probably. And this is part of the complicated math here, because different schools are making different calculations. We had some schools, like Colorado being one of them. There's been a few others that have decided, we're not going to have a collective. We're going to do everything in-house so we can control it, and we can verify that everybody's actually getting paid at the right amount of time, and we're just going to do it in-house.
Wait, who said that? Colorado?
Yeah.
Is that
Colorado?
Colorado
is one of these, yes.
Is that Coach Prime or the athletic director, or is the athletic director there?
Rick George is the athletic director. That was a university decision. Okay. And their collective wasn't very big anyway.
So how do they
move this all in-house?
So if that's the case, how are they not de facto employees of the university?
That is a great question, and the answer is a judge hasn't said they're employees yet.
Okay.
And there are many economists and many labor activists who said, my goodness, if the school's going to cut a check for $700,000 for a small forward on the basketball team, of course they're employees. And that is something that judges are going to be having to address over the coming months and years, and also potentially Congress. Because Congress could just say, I don't care what a judge says, here's a new law, college football players aren't employees. And then that kind of just settles that.
But now we're getting to labor law and who's an employee and who's contract labor, and then that brings in benefits, et cetera, correct?
It does. And that's a major reason why so many universities have spent so much time lobbying Congress, both previous Congresses with Democrats and Republicans, and also this current Congress, which is, you know, uniformly controlled by Republicans, to prevent exactly that from happening. LSU LSU could definitely afford a world where every one of their football players is an employee and gets workers' comp and Social Security and all the benefits that come with that. But then doing that for 600 athletes across the entire athletic department becomes extremely expensive. And it becomes probably impossible if you are a Southland school or a Division II or a Division III institution. And so that is something the schools don't want. We're going to have to see if the court system or if the legislative branch agrees with that.
You know, when it comes to benefits, one thing somebody texted in about, and it's a good question, if a basketball forward or a running back or a swimmer or somebody tears a tendon or breaks a bone and they got to go to get medical treatment and physical therapy, prescription drugs, et cetera, who pays for all of that now?
That's a great question. Right now, it's paid for by the school. Mm-hmm. And this was actually a major source of contention among athlete activists and attorneys before the NIL era, because previously it used to be, if you were, you know, running back and it's your senior year and you tear your ACL in the second to last game of the season and you have rehab that might continue after you've graduated, that's on you. The school wouldn't pay for it. Now there are insurance plans to be able to pay for some, the health care for some of those injuries after graduation. But right now, that's one of the biggest expenses for athletic departments across the country is insurance and medical care for athletes who are injured.
How about when did that change, if you had to guess, Matt?
When did it change to be able to add?
Well where the insurance, where it's like, well, okay, you know, you're going to play for us, we'll at least insure your health or get you healthy.
I want to say that, you know, this is actually a good question here on the spot. I want to say that that's been covered for athletes during your athletic play since at least the 1980s.
Okay.
But it's a good question. That's something I should look up afterwards.
Because I remember in high school hurting a knee, and I don't remember exactly who paid for that, if it was my parents or if it was the school or what, but that was a long time ago. I did just the question popped up. When you say up to $20 million as a school, where's that $20 million coming from?
Great question. So universities, again, big or small, bring in revenue from a variety of different sources. You might make money from your television contract. You make money from selling tickets and parking spaces and beer and popcorn. You make money from participating and winning NCAA tournament games and from licensing, right? From selling T-shirts and letting people, you know, reproduce your stuff throughout the country. All of that stuff is what we would call earned revenue, and that's where the $20 million comes from. A bunch of economists looked at all that earned revenue across the Power Four and did some plussing and minusing and came up with this as an average. But any school can decide to pay up to that $20 million no matter how much money or where that money is coming in. So theoretically, if you are an FCS institution who plays in front of 800 people in the gym, you could decide to pay $10, $20 million and just take that money from student fees or from somewhere else in the university and split that. All it says is this is the cap. This is how we calculated the cap. Where you get the money to pay for that, that's between you, God, and the Board of Regents.
That's a salary cap per school for every sport. Men's and women's, which brings us to Title IX, and we'll pick that up when we come back, all right?
You bet.
I also want to talk more about Grant House, the Arizona State swimmer behind all of this, an All-American, an honor student. His days are over, so back pay is going to be a part of this? Is he suing for the people ahead of him? So many questions. And I also want you to address this because somebody texted in and said, 100% do not agree with paying college athletes, and you can tell us a little bit about the historical context of that. We're talking about paying college athletes and name, image, and likeness and salary caps and more. Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter, is our guest, 504-260-1870. If you have any questions or comments, back in a flash, Tommy Tucker, WWL. 927, talking to our good friend Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. How do people find that, Matt?
You can find the Extra Points newsletter at extrapointsmb.com. You can find me at Matt Brown EP on Twitter.
All right, let's talk about Title IX as it relates to this proposed House settlement. Tell me first, for people that think they know about it but don't know of it, tell me about Title IX.
Great question. I think a lot of people forget that Title IX wasn't actually originally created with athletics in mind. But this is the federal statute that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in educational programming. Mm-hmm. What that has historically meant, based on how it's been interpreted over the last several years, is that athletic departments need to provide equivalent numbers of high level athletic opportunity for men and women. So if you're depending on your enrollments, if you're 52% women undergrad, your scholarship count has to be proportionate there. You can't spend all of your money just on football and men's basketball. Now, most people aren't actually compliant with this law. It tends to only get enforced when somebody sues. Mm-hmm. But schools generally at least make an effort to be compliant with how they distribute and spend money to not be discriminatory.
So give me an obtuse example or something that would be Title IX terribly misapplied, adhering to the letter of the law, that would make no sense. If you can.
Well, so it's funny you mention this, right? Like, an example might be, okay, the football team has 85 scholarships. It brings in X amount of money, and our football budget to account for all of those is $10 million. We now need to spend $10 million on softball, which has a much smaller roster. Like which was a major fear that many administrators had in the 70s and early 80s. That's not typically how it works. But to kind of bring this into what we're talking about now, a couple of days before the Biden administration left the White House, their Department of Education put out a memo that said, listen, based on our interpretation of previous case law, and this is something I heard from a lot of other Title IX litigators, our belief that the amount of the money that's distributed via this House settlement needs to follow the same equivalency rules for Title IX, which would mean you can't spend 85% of that $20 million just on football and men's basketball. It would need to be equivalent, men and women, like your scholarship spending is. Trump White House comes in, immediately rescind that memo, say, we don't believe that, which then leads, I think, to an actual difficult situation if you're an athletic director or a university president right now. How do I comply with this law when I don't 100% know who's going to enforce it and what the law is going to be in 4 or 5 years if there's a change in the election? But I also have to win a championship now. It puts them in a challenging spot.
When it comes to women's athletics, softball is now on ESPN. I don't know how popular it is nationally or not. You know, ESPN. I don't mean to demean women's softball, but I was watching Air Guitar the other day, which just because it's on ESPN, that doesn't mean anything. We all know women's college basketball, LSU. It's better, but the women's Lady Tigers are more popular than the Man Tigers right now. However you phrase it.
Yep.
So I guess. Where's the egg and where's the chicken? Did Title IX lead to the development of the popularity of ladies' college basketball or even softball? Or did the market lead to that? And is reversal of Title IX going to affect any of that or make it less relevant?
So these are very good questions. And in my professional opinion, I think it's impossible to say that Title IX didn't have a role in expanding the popularity for many women's sports, in large part because it helped increase the participation in those sports. Before Title IX, wasn't uncommon at all for high schools throughout the country to not have competitive women's programs. Like if you wanted to play high-level softball in 1972, in a lot of places, you couldn't. With Title IX and the expansion of high school sports on so many levels and then ultimately into college, you're able to have generations of people who are going to be invested in softball and volleyball and basketball because they've been able to play it for years, which they weren't able to do before. We also have, I think, the push to actually televise and market these events in a meaningful way. And this is something that a lot of women's sports advocates will push back on and say, like, of course, women's basketball does not make as much money as men's basketball right now. You guys had an 80-year head start. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get anybody to put our stuff on television or tweet it, and we couldn't get any reporters. And now we finally begin to do that. Look at that. Our Final Four outdraws you. I think that the truth is probably a little bit of both things. But this would be some of the concern that if you're going to take a strictly revenue-oriented approach to how you distribute your money, of course it's going to go overwhelmingly to men. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the women's sports can't become more popular or can't grow. They just didn't have the resources and the infrastructure that the men did over the last several decades.
Where do the Olympics factor in all of this in terms of ladies' gymnastics, volleyball, beach volleyball, some other things that are very popular, basketball, et cetera? Because what feeds what here, Matt?
Yeah, this is, I think, a very difficult and complicated policy question, honestly. You know, something that I think many Americans don't realize is the system that we use to train our athletes for the Olympics, which has been the best in the world,
track
I think,
and field.
For the last several decades.
I shouldn't have left out track and field, but go ahead, please.
No, sure. Yeah, track and field, all of these things. Like, you know, the American system right now really is the envy of the world, but we do it differently than everybody else. What almost every industrialized country does is have a federal minister of sports, like a federal government program that trains many of these athletes rather than the university system or something that's outsourced. In some countries, the military helps. Sometimes it's the government that pays for it. Here, we've outsourced that development to Division I universities. And men and women from all over the world will come and try to compete at American colleges for swimming and track and field because the training that you're going to get at Stanford or Cal is better than you're going to get at, you know, the National Brazilian Swimming Complex or maybe even in some places in Europe. A major concern right now among so many sport federations, whether that's track and field, swimming, wrestling, the softball, the whole works, is if we move to a world where schools now can dedicate even more resources specifically to football and men's basketball. They're going to drop, and we have roster limits for all these other sports, they're going to drop many of these Olympic sports, which do not generate revenue. And if that happens, we will not be as good at the Olympics. We need to come up with a different system to pay for all of these things. And there's a couple of ideas out there right now, but there's not really any momentum towards making any of them concrete policy.
Take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Matt House, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Let me just get this in real quick for the person that said they're against college athletes being paid. Just a 60-second tutorial on the history of that, Matt.
I would say that this has been a debate we've been having for about as long as we've been having college sports, all the way back to the 1890s. College athletes have been paid via the black market since the 1890s, since Yale and Princeton were good at sports. Now the market has evolved, and the industry brings in a lot more money. That's where the debate has shifted to now moving forward.
Yeah, analogous to legalized betting as opposed to non-legalized betting. People are saying, well, now people are betting on football games because it's legal, when in fact they always were.
I think there's something to that. I mean, a lot more people are betting on football games now than they were before. You don't have to go down to a bookie somewhere in a basement. But yes, this is a market just like for alcohol, just like for drugs, just like for many things that has always existed, regardless of whether it was legal or not.
When we come back, we'll talk about collective bargaining, group licensing with college athletes. Did I say Matt House? Did I call you Matt House?
You did, but it's okay. This happens all the time. I got one of those names.
Matt House is an LSU coach. That's where I'm getting. That was an LSU coach. Grant House is a swimmer that's involved in the suit. It's got nothing to do with the House of Representatives. Or does it? We'll find out more when we come back. 9:36, Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 9:43, 17 till 10, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Point newsletter, talking about the... When are they supposed to rule on this settlement, the House settlement, $20 million salary cap?
There will be a hearing on April 7th, and Lord willing, we will have some kind of definitive answer a couple of days after that.
But if there is, something's going to be appealed or not?
There's almost certainly going to be litigation following this, particularly about the fair market value and trying to legislate deals that aren't through the school. But what the lawyers that are involved with this tell me is if this settlement's approved, the framework will exist while all of the other lawsuits and appeals process are going on. So, you know, barring something crazy, this will be the system for this coming football season.
And even with that phrase, fair market value, that begs the question, what's fair? To whom, right?
Exactly. Right now, the major conferences have hired Deloitte to help calculate this, indexing against a bunch of other comparable terms. But I'm sure that there will be additional lawsuits from economists and from labor lawyers and from agents. It's kind of a trite joke at this point in this business, but it really is the truth. The most powerful force in college athletics is not recruiting. It's not Alabama. It's not the Big Ten. It's billable hours.
Mm-hmm.
And if I knew exactly how this stuff was going to end, I would not be in the media business.
There's your real winner right there. Billable hours. Let's talk about collective bargaining as far as the athletes go. And would that be by team? Would that be by school? Would it be by sport? By gender, sex, what does that look like?
So these are very good questions. And for people that may not be aware, one of the things that collective bargaining lets you do is create a collective bargaining agreement, or a CBA, that governs the rules for how athletes are paid, how rosters are constructed. It's something that every professional sports league has. So that's why you don't have free agency every single year in the NFL. Like, there's a CBA that dictates this is when you can hit free agency, this is your salary band, and there's rules, and it creates some semblance of predictability. The NBA has this as well, Major League Baseball, everything else. College sports does not have this, and a major reason why is you can't have a collective bargaining agreement or have collective bargaining right now without somebody to bargain with. Mm-hmm. In the pros, there's a players' union. You can't have a union in this country without being employees. And right now, college athletes aren't employees. There's a lot of really challenging legal questions about how you get to collective bargaining, even if you don't have employees, or if you do, who creates that unit? We have some states in the South where public employees can't collectively bargain. So are the athletes employees of LSU? Are they employees of the SEC? Are they employees of a completely third-party entity that's created to get around some of these rules? We don't know. We don't know if the CBA would cover conference football players, sports-specific football players, something wider. All of that has to be hashed out by the people that organize athletes and by a variety of judges, and it tends to be a long, complicated, and expensive process.
Talk about group licensing, Matt.
Sure. So group licensing is important because if you are somebody that enjoys, say, sports video games like Madden or EA Sports College Football 25, the reason that you're able to enjoy those games with the actual New Orleans Saints or the actual players on LSU is through something called a group license, where EA or another video game publisher will go and say, we're not going to individually negotiate 2,000 contracts, or in the case of college football, over 11,000 contracts. We're going to create one big contract, and everybody can either opt into that and get paid, or they can opt out and not be in the game. There's a couple of companies that help facilitate this. I wrote about this today. There's a new one that's trying to break into the college athlete space to give athletes more money for their participation in video games and to try and make it easier for other video game publishers to use college athletes to make games, potentially a return of the college basketball video game series that's been discontinued, college baseball, other sports. Part of the hangup is figuring out the licensing angle to make sure that all the schools and all the athletes are being paid, because otherwise the game wouldn't be nearly as much fun.
All right, let's say I decide I'm a highly recruited athlete and I'm going to LSU playing football, and they pay me, Canes pays me to do commercials as Tommy Tucker. Can I do commercials as Tommy Tucker wearing an LSU jersey, or can I just wear a purple and gold jersey that looks a lot like an LSU jersey? If I wear an LSU jersey, is that LSU's property? Do they have to get some of that money? Is one part of the other?
Yeah, these are great questions, and the answer is this is why you have an agent. This is what, because the rules are often different from school to school. Generally speaking, if you want to do that Canes commercial as Tommy Tucker and you play for LSU, you need to get LSU's permission to have the Bengal or LSU's specific intellectual property in that shot. Sometimes schools will let you have it for free. Sometimes schools say you can use it, but you have to pay the same licensing fee that we charge anybody else. Sometimes they reach a different conclusion. Sometimes they say no. LSU might say, you can't do that because we actually have a university-wide deal with Popeyes. Mm. And, we'll go to licensing jail if our jersey shows up in Canes. So you have to wear a white shirt or something that's not purple and gold. And these are things that get hashed out and kind of litigated in almost every big commercial, because huge universities like LSU and Ohio State and Texas, they have so many commercial relationships. It does take somebody some time to comb through and figure out what are we actually legally allowed to do based on our other contracts.
Talk about college agents and their increasing involvement in this.
Yeah, sure. So, what we just described is kind of a complicated thing, right? To figure out, who owns what intellectual property and how much should I make or charge for this particular commercial? And do I still get paid if I tear my ACL or what if I flunk Spanish or something? These are all difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And they can be hard for college students to figure out. So you typically have an agent or somebody helping you negotiate and follow through with these kind of deals. Part of the challenge is that an agent to represent somebody in the NFL or the NBA has to be certified by that players' union. And that generally means you had to pass some sort of exam. You almost always have a graduate degree. Most of the time you're a lawyer, or you have to have a lot of professional experience. There's baselines to get certified that show I have a minimum level of competence. In college, this market is almost completely unregulated. So you have a lot of people who's like, I have an agent, and my agent is this guy in the dorm down the hall, or it's my buddy's uncle. Or it's somebody that we found from Twitter who's not qualified whatsoever, and they might be charging exorbitant fees. They might be providing bad advice. They might be pushing athletes to transfer every 6 months to try to get more money. And this is a difficult thing for everybody to deal with here. It's frustrating for schools and coaches because it's hard to negotiate with somebody who's incompetent or maybe unethical. And it's difficult for athletes too, because I don't know about you, Tommy. Like when I was 17, 18, 19, I didn't know that many attorneys. I had absolutely no idea what to ask or how to figure out what a good attorney was. It's the part that's kind of like me trying to find a plumber now. Yeah, I don't know what questions to ask. It'd be pretty easy for me to get taken advantage
that
of.
And that
happens a lot in this world.
And you'd sell yourself without thinking about the future for something shiny right now. And that's
of course.
And the other question I have is, how far down does this go? Is this going down to high school now, name, image, and likeness? Because I think in Texas, as big as high school football is, it wouldn't surprise me to see, you know, I'm thinking about Hank Hill and McManaberry, whomever it was, pay a name, image, and likeness to a running back or something like that. Does it go to high school or not?
In some cases, it does. Part of that is because, you know, often by the time someone's a sophomore or a junior, you'll know if they have the potential to be a five-star recruit. If you're somebody that's on the pathway to playing in the NBA, you're often a known quantity by the time you're 15, 16, and 17. And so some companies will want to do actual commercial deals with those folks, especially if they're trying to reach younger consumers. But just like the bag men of yore would be interested in paying athletes and developing relationships with them when they were still in high school, so would the boosters or anybody else trying to curry recruiting favor. And in some sports, that actually does make good business sense to target somebody that young, because that's where the influencers and that's where the money is.
Mm-hmm. Who's going to ultimately be the winner and loser here, do you know?
that's a tough question, Tommy. I mean, like, I think there will be winners and losers,
you know that.
Yeah. And I would say, as frustrating and as chaotic as this era can be, particularly if you're a fan, this is probably not a good time to be a football coach. Mm. It's a great time to be a college athlete. You are able to get more benefits and more money than you ever have before, even if you are not a five-star LSU or Texas football player. There's financial and professional opportunities out there that you didn't have before if you play women's lacrosse or men's gymnastics or men's soccer. And I think that is a net positive. But generally with these things, like with a lot of industries, the ultimate big winners are going to be a lot of the biggest businesses and biggest brands. I would be pretty confident that no matter how the chips fall, LSU's probably going to be fine. Is Tulane? Probably not. Or it's going to be much harder for them, just like anybody else trying to compete in the agency space against CAA or the Wassermans or these gigantic businesses of the world.
If it's not a mess, it'll do till one gets here. Thank you, Matt Brown, publisher of the Extra Points newsletter. Quick break. We'll find out what Newell's got when we come back on WWL.